Sorry for being late, but these guys are responsible. But they actually pointed out a problem in one of the problems which you should be aware of before you sink too much time into it. So in question 2.7.2, it's not clear that these three Yukawa interactions are actually going to be invariant on the symmetries. So when you get to that point, sorry? So in the question that came up before this, before I came here, was in problem 2.7.2, you're looking at the properties of a colored scalar field, which is basically a supersymmetric partner of a quark. And there are three new Yukawa interactions you're supposed to be writing down. They're showing that they're invariant. And it's not completely clear that they're invariant. So I'm gonna go. I think there's a problem with those interactions. And I'm gonna. This is not a question that I set, so I don't have the solution at the top of my head. So what I'll do is I'll email you guys with a rephrasing of what those interactions should be. Okay. But just so you were aware that there's an issue there, so you don't sink weeks and weeks into trying to understand that particular one point. Unfortunately, there's not an equation number there I can point to, but it's the midway through that 2.7.2, there's a list of three interactions which are Yukawa interactions, which are the ones that are suspicious. Right, that's right. I can't remember which one that was. That's a typo.
Morphism transformation. It turns out they're not actually invariant under them. And the reason is you see the same problem with the spin network states. Spin network states aren't invariant under diffeomorphisms because if you shift the connection and keep the graph fixed, that's equivalent to shifting the graph.
That's the Bob room, really?
Is the connection fixed.
Is that being broadcast here?
Or is because of this property, we can group average, and you can come up with a.
It sounds like that's not just random noise, right?
And that's basically the idea we're going to do. That's the same trick we're going to use here. Notice that in this case, phi represents a diffeomorphism and an SU2 gauge transformation, acting on the state.
Are we getting the Bob room piped in?
It acts on the connection configuration. So that's equivalent to the curvature R, essentially.
Well, we should be able to drown that out.
But because of this property, now we can group average to the.
Yeah, he wants to turn the knob the wrong way. Good. Yeah, that's better. Thanks. So one of these. I think it's the 2.1, where you're finding that the hypercharges of these various fields are fixed by various things. It says take the hypercharge of the Higgs field to be exactly minus a half, which is not what we were doing in class. It was plus a half. So that's just a typo. It should just be plus a half. It's just it's what it's always been. As you find those kind of typos, you should say, someone pointed that one out to me, and thanks for doing that. But I'll make a publicly available list so you can kind of see what they all are. And so I don't know if there's any others anyone wants to point out while we're here. That's a standard trick, right? which one is that? Using equivalent 1.90. Oh, right, yeah. You don't want to use that one. Actually, 1.93 is what I think you should probably be using there. Yeah, I don't know what equation you're supposed to be using there, but use them all. Use them all and use them repeatedly. Which one are you worried about?
So the 1.9.
Okay. So the sine is harder to check than the 8. And this actually came up before. Someone else was doing this one, and you get minus a half. So you're all voting for minus a quarter, is it? Yeah, the 8, I've had that. I think I've had this conversation with Michael too, right? Do you have the 8? Right. And so, at the end of the day, do you think that the 8's right, or are you not sure? Okay. Yeah. So I can tell you guys that the ones. So. The identities in 1.1, you can take to the bank because I've checked them a million times. The identities in excuse me. In 1.9, the only one that I'm doubtful of is this last one that you're worried about. So it's I'll check that one myself. Just to the sine and the factors of 2 would be the dangerous ones there. The factors of 2 normally you can get straight. And so I'll check them for you. Okay. Any other questions? All right. So we're doing z decays into things, and we're assuming its momentum is k, its spin is c, it's decaying into a fermion with momentum p, and spin sigma, an antifermion with momentum p bar. Spin sigma bar. So this is what emerged as being the thing to which z's can decay if we worked to linear order in the interaction terms in the standard model. If we worked to second order, then there'd be other things that we could have also had a non-zero matrix element for, which we'll get to later on. For those of you who kind of know Feynman rules, just to see where we're going, this corresponds to a process where we have a Z. There's a process, there's an interaction where it produces a fermion and an antifermion. So we have momentum K, momentum P, and momentum P bar. And the arrow traditionally on a fermion line is telling you the direction of flow of fermion numbers. So if momentum is moving in the direction of the arrow, or time, if the arrow is pointing forward in time, if we're thinking time going that way, that's a fermion, and this would be an antifermion, is what the notation is there. I'll come back to exactly what the Feynman rules are in detail next term, but the amplitude that we wrote down here for this process, we got I, there's a sign on it, I can't remember, I'll have to check again. And we had the polarization vector for the spin one particle. And then we had the spinner, u bar. For the fermion, we had a u spinner. Then we had the gamma matrices that were in the interaction. So we had T3 gamma left minus q sine squared theta w. And then we had a v spinner for the antifermion. I guess we got to close the bracket here. And the sign, I don't know if I got that right. No, I got the sign wrong there. And what this picture is supposed to be telling you is that this amplitude has a bunch of factors in it. There's the line factors are to do with the lines that kind of start and end and describe the particles that we're starting with or ending with. They're corresponding to the particles in the process. And there's factors in this amplitude that go with those. So for the there's a factor in the amplitude associated with the spin one particle, which is basically this one. And that came from the fact that went along with in the decomposition of the Z field in terms of creation annihilation operators. We had something like sum over zeta integral d3 L of epsilon mu of L zeta e to the I LX A L zeta plus the other term. The thing that was destroying a particle that was coming in had as a prefactor this. And I'm not, we didn't write this down because this is associated with the delta function of the thing that gave us energy momentum conservation. So what this is, this part of the graph is telling you is that there's a factor that you should be thinking about, which is associated with the destruction of the initial particle in the problem, which had to be destroyed by one of the fields. It's always coming along with this polarization vector because that's always in the field with the destruction operator. There's factors that are associated with the creation of the initial and final particles, and that's these ones. So those are the analogs of the polarization vector for the spin a half fields. When we write the expansion of the fermionic fields, there's a similar piece, similar decomposition. The role of the polarization vector is being played by the spinners. If we looked at what was the thing that went with the creation of a particle, it was U, the U spinner. The thing that went with the creation of an antiparticle was the V spinner. And so these parts of the graph correspond to these factors in the amplitude. And the dot is the thing that goes with the interaction term. So these factors and these factors came from the interaction term, which was I E over sine theta W, cos theta W, Z mu, sum over fermion bar, gamma mu, T3 gamma left minus Q sine squared theta W fermion. And so a lot of these other factors are coming along for the ride because they were the interaction that was responsible for the perturbation theory, and that's what the dot is telling you to write. And there's three lines coming from the dot because there were three fields in this interaction which could have been creating and destroying things. And the picture is just telling you in an efficient way that you were interested in the part of this picture of this interaction which destroyed a Z boson, and that came with this factor epsilon. It created a particle and antiparticle, and that came with these factors U and V, and then it had some baggage from the interaction that goes along with it. And all the more complicated final graphs are expressing the same thing. They're all connections of dots and lines, and the dots are to do with all the coefficients that are in the interaction of Lagrangian that's relevant for a particular order of perturbation theory. The external lines that begin or end the graph are the ones associated with the creation and destruction of the particles that were in the initial and final state. The only thing that this graph doesn't have, which a general graph could have, is an internal line which connects two dots. And that's the thing that I may or may not get to, but if we had done second order perturbation theory, so we had two interaction Hamiltonians, and so we had two terms in the Lagrangian, and so we had two dots in the graph, there's a situation where the particle that's created from one interaction could have been destroyed by the other interaction, and that involves a time ordering of those interactions and a matrix element, which doesn't refer at all to the initial and final particles. And that also has a corresponding factor that appears in the amplitude, which we can calculate, but which has not been calculated yet. But it has a specific form, which you can calculate once and for all. And once you know what it is, then you just write a factor of that whenever you see a line that's connecting two dots. So the Feynman rules are just expressing in an efficient way the combinatorics of the matrix elements of creation annihilation operators. Because at the end of the day, that's all you're doing, is you've got an initial particle, a final particle, some operators in between, which are built out of fields through things like these, and they ultimately involve creation annihilation operators, and then they have to destroy or create the right number of particles to get a non-zero matrix element. And there's often many ways that they can do that, and the combinatorics of how they do that is what these graphs are capturing, and so that's all they're really for. So this is like the simplest graph. That's why it's the simplest one to calculate. So at the end of the day, what we're supposed to do is take this thing and calculate what we really want to know is the rate for the decay. So So it'll be a function of all these momenta, you know, k, zeta, c, I guess, p, sigma, p bar, sigma bar. And I've already forgotten what the express, where the two pi's go in the expression that it gives that. This is why you never need to remember anything for this course. It's always, the reason that people have books is so you can look things up, right? 1 over 2e. So we had a 2 pi to the fourth. So we have a delta function in which you saw how this thing was appeared. This factor appeared by doing the integral over space, integral d4x of the x dependence of all these things. And that x dependence always appeared as a phase. It evolved a different momenta, sometimes with a plus momentum, sometimes with a minus momentum, depending on if we were creating or destroying in the fields. And that integral over x gave us this delta function which conserved momentum, which we knew always had to be there. And that was the thing that we ignored when we were picking off this m term. And there's a 1 over twice the energy of the initial particle, which in this case is k0. And then there's the matrix element squared times product of d3p and d3p bar, the two final state momenta, divided by 2 pi cubed times twice the energy of that one, and divided by 2 pi cubed times twice the energy of that one. If I've done that right. Yes. All right, so the only trick here is to calculate this matrix element squared and to group the two pi's, which is also, we might as well do that. So let's group the two pi's. We've got, altogether, there's going to be a 1 over 8 because of all the energy denominators, a 2 pi squared, the delta function that we know and love, times m squared over k naught, p naught, p bar naught, d3p, d3p bar. Right, so what's m squared? Here it is. So m squared, we're going to lose the minus I, so we get to poke the i's out. And we just have this overall coupling constant factor. So we have e squared over sine squared cos squared. And then we have this thing. So we have, that's epsilon mu, okay. I'll stop writing the arguments here. We have epsilon star nu times this thing times its complex conjugate. So we have times u bar gamma mu times this matrix. I'm going to call this whole matrix M. Too many M's. Let's call it something else. Let's call it N. V times u bar gamma nu N V complex conjugate. So, excuse me. So this is where these identities are useful a little bit. So we have we've got two choices here now. Let's focus on the spinner part of things. So for the spinner part, the idea is to write this thing in terms of traces over gamma matrices, because those are the simplest thing. Those are very simple to evaluate for the most part. So step one is this is the trick, the trace of gamma matrix trick. So first step is to write this complex conjugate out. So you know we had u bar gamma nu m and v complex conjugate. So that's v dagger n dagger gamma nu dagger beta dagger, which is beta times u. So I just put in the definition that u bar is u dagger beta, and beta is hermitian. And we know a lot about the properties of these gamma matrices. So what do we know? In particular, we know that beta gamma mu, if you take any of the basis matrices, 1, gamma 5, gamma mu, gamma 5, or the commutator of 2 gamma mus, they all have the property that if I take their adjoint and I slap beta on both sides of them, I get a sine at most. So if I take, I claim that this is an identity. This is minus gamma mu. If I'd done this for the unit matrix, I would have got gamma, the unit matrix dagger was 1, so then beta squared is 1, and so I would have got equal to plus 1. If I'd done this for gamma 5, I would have had gamma 5 dagger is gamma 5. Gamma 5 anti-commutes with beta, so I get a minus sign, beta squared is 1, so then I would have gotten equal to minus gamma 5. And so all of the gamma matrices have a simple property, all the basis matrices have a simple property that if you take their, slapping beta on both sides is up to a sign giving you the same answer as if you take the adjoint. And so it's worth, and you use those identities in those in the, what you proved in the first question in the assignment. So if we use that, then you can see that I might as well put beta here for free, because another property is that beta squared is 1, because beta is just the matrix, you know, 0, 1, 1, 0. And so I might as well do it again here. And that allows me to write this as being V bar, beta n dagger beta, times minus gamma nu times u. And all we need to know is what this is. So what was n? N was this matrix here, right? Or just without the gamma matrix, that was n. So it's basically a linear combination of 1 and gamma 5. So since n is t3 gamma left minus q sine squared theta w, and since beta 1 dagger beta is beta squared is 1, and beta gamma 5 dagger beta is beta gamma 5 beta, because gamma 5 is the matrix 1, 0, 0, minus 1, and that's minus beta squared gamma 5, so that's minus gamma 5. That shows you that slapping beta on both sides and adjoining doesn't do anything to the 1s, and it changes the signs of the gamma 5. So if I do it for n, I take beta n dagger beta, it's going to be t3, that's a real number, complex conjugation does nothing to it. Gamma left is going to go to gamma right, and minus q sine squared theta, right? So this is v bar, I could call this n bar if you like. Let's call it n bar. So all it is gamma left went to gamma right. Or maybe better, what I'll do is I'll call this n left, just to emphasize that had the gamma left in it, and this will become n right. Overall minus sign, gamma nu u. So that's the first step. Now the second step in running this thing as a trace is just to, this is like a stupid step. So we have u bar, this factor here is u bar gamma mu nv, and then I just calculated that this complex conjugate here was minus v bar, this is n left, n right, gamma nu u. Another way I could write this is I could put the n on the other side of the gamma matrix, and then the 1 goes through for free. The gamma 5 changes sign when I anti-commute them, because they anti-commute. So this could equally well be written minus v bar gamma nu n left u. And then that looks very much like what we had before here, with the gamma matrix on the left and the n on the right. The next trick is to write this combination. So what we really, if I put in, let me write in the Dirac indices just to make the point I want to make. If I write the Dirac indices, this has a Dirac index, let's say A. This is a matrix, gamma mu, n left, AB, and this is a column vector B, and those indices are all summed. This is, there's an overall minus sign, that one. I have V bar C, I've got a matrix here, gamma nu, n left, CD, and then the U, D. And so
The very deep thought that goes in next is to write this. Now these are all numbers, right? There's a sum over all these indices, but this is no longer a column vector. This is now a row vector. It's just, since I put the index in explicitly here, I'm just giving you the complex number, which is the element of that column vector. And this is the element of a matrix. And then the matrix multiplication that's in here is really in the sum over these indices A, B, C, and D. So since it's a number, I can equally well write it here. And so another way of thinking of this is that this combination, which is a column vector index B and a row vector with index C, I can think of that as being a matrix, which is like taking a vector times its transpose. So I can think of that as being the matrix V, V bar, B, C. I can call that the matrix U, U bar, B, A, where the idea is if V had been a, you know, here's V1, V2, V4, and V bar involves the adjoint, so you think of that as being V bar 1, V bar 2, V bar 3, V bar 4. All this is, you know, V bar V would have been take the column vector with the row vector and get a number. But V, V bar is the dyadic, which corresponds to taking this row vector times this column vector to get a matrix. So V, V bar would be the matrix, which is, you know, V1, V1 bar, V1, V2 bar, and so on, V2, V1 bar, right? Fill the matrix that way, and that's what this is a matrix. It's a stupid statement, right? All I'm just doing is writing things out. But having written it that way, this is now a trace. I've got matrix multiplication, and I get a matrix whose begins and ends with the same index, which I sum over. So this is the same thing as the trace of gamma mu n left, the matrix V, V bar, gamma nu n right, matrix U, U bar. No. So if I wrote that out, right, V bar was V dagger beta. So if I wrote that as being V1, V2, V3, V4, and this is 0, 1, 1, 0. So then, well, what'll happen is that V bar 1 is what I mean here. That's going to be, you know, V3 star, things like that. So think of this as being, it's the row vector V bar, the first element in that row vector, not the first element of V barred. They should be, yeah. Thank you. Quarter. fight. All right. So this is useful, provided that you know what this matrix is, U, U bar. And that's one of the exercises, right? And so I can tell you what that is in the conventions that I'm used to, but let me make sure I get it right in the conventions that I'm not used to here. Yeah. So the claim is that U and V depend on momenta and spin, right? So U, this is really U of P sigma. U bar, the same P, the same sigma. That's a matrix. It's built into these coefficients. These coefficients in the book are some explicit functions of momentum that you could think of as being solutions to the Dirac equation, if you like. But they're known things, and so this is a known function of momentum. But these spinners have been chosen to transform in a covariant way, and so they're going to have a simple form. If you write this dyadic in terms of gamma mu, gamma 5, gamma 5, and 1, this is going to have a very simple answer because it's been designed to transform covariantly, and those matrices are the ones that are also chosen because they have covariant transformation properties. And so it's fairly simple to write out what these things are. The expression is that you get is fairly simple. It's going to depend on it can depend on the mass of the particle, because that's that's appears in the energy, the zeroth component of the momentum. It's going to depend on the four vector p mu. It has to depend on the spin. And so the one thing I need to tell you is how to write the spin in a way which is not a number 1/2 or 1. It has to depend on it's going to depend on the spin through a vector which is associated with the spin. So let me write down what it is, and then we can come back to what the definition of this vector is. So the claim is, which you show in the homework, is that this is 1/2 m minus I p slash 1 plus I gamma 5 s slash. So you understand what m is, you understand what p slash is, that's just p mu gamma mu. This is s mu gamma mu, and I need to tell you what s is. So what's s? S is a four vector. It's defined in the rest frame. So in the rest frame of this particle, that's the frame where p mu has the zeroth component is the mass, and then all the space components are zero. In that frame, sigma meant, you know, what did sigma mean? Sigma meant it was the component of spin in the z direction, or your favorite direction, defined in the rest frame of the particle. So sigma carries within it two things. It gets the value 1/2, but it also is in the direction, it's in the direction in which you chose to diagonalize the one component of angular momentum. And so this S is the thing that carries that information. So it's defined to be in the same frame. It's purely in the space direction, and it's otherwise a unit direction, a unit vector which points in the direction of the spin, that you measure the spin. So it's called a unit vector E. In direction, you measure the spin sigma. Sigma equals plus or minus 1/2 is measured. So that means that it has two invariant properties that you can say right away. So that I've defined it for you in a specific frame, and then the way you get it in a general frame is you do a Lorentz transformation to the frame you're interested in. And so, but in particular, you know that that S mu, that's a Lorentz invariant thing. If I calculate it in this frame, it's true in all frames. That's going to be equal to plus 1, because it would be minus the time component squared, which is 0, plus the space component squared, but that was 1 because that's a unit vector. Yeah? Oh, yeah, you're saying that you want me to have the sign here. Yeah, yeah, I'm happy with that. Yeah. You going to charge me a quarter for that? Why not? A little dangerously. And it also has the property that S mu P mu is zero, because this is purely in the space direction and this is purely in the time direction, so they're orthogonal in the rest frame. So they have to be orthogonal in all frames if we do a Lorentz transformation away from that. And those are the properties that are going to be most useful later on. So that's the definition, and that's what this UU bar is. VU bar is very similar. The only difference, I think, is that the mass term is the opposite sign, if I remember right. Yeah. So if you take m to minus m, it's the same thing for VU bar. So also the claim is, and this again is just a matter of evaluating, starting from the definitions of U and U bar, V of P sigma, V bar, same P, same sigma, is 1/2 minus m minus I p slash 1 plus I gamma 5 s slash. And I think the half is there, right? That's also right. So that's what makes this expression useful, is that we can use this expression in here. And now we've got traces involving gamma MHCs that we know and love. So the thing we want to calculate is m squared is, let me just rewrite it here so I can erase this board. It's e squared over sine squared cos squared epsilon mu epsilon nu star times this fermion stuff. There was an overall minus sign that came out because of the minus sign that came in at this step here, that minus sign. So we're going to minus. That looks funny because it makes it look like this, the positive thing is going to be negative, but it's because the thing we're going to write it next to is negative. And there's a trace of, there's two factors of a half. You know, this a half comes in twice, so let's write that out. We have 4 here. And we've got the, so we have the gamma mu n times a VV bar, and VV bar is this one, so we have a minus sign from this one goes there and kills this one. That's the minus sign. We have M plus I P slash 1 plus I gamma 5 S slash. Then we have gamma nu N again. Then we have the UU bar, which was M minus I P slash 1 plus I gamma 5 S slash. And this is S bar, because that's the one that's just, and this is P bar, because this is the momenta which appear in the spinner V, and that was P bar and sigma bar. And this is P and sigma, because those are the ones which were for the fermion. So now we want to just take some traces, and we want to know what to do with these things. There's two ways to go here. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to not follow the spin degrees of freedom in this calculation, although in the chapter I keep track of those degrees of freedom as well in the notes. So what I would like to do now is to, you know, so far we've been calculating the differential rate. What I want to do now is this would give us the rate for a polarized Z particle to decay into pairs of fermions with specific spins. What I want to do now is not measure the spins, so I'm going to, what that corresponds to is summing over all possible spins. And I'm going to imagine that we're going to start off with an unpolarized Z particle. That's to say, let's say we didn't know what the Z polarization was, so we'll say it's got a 30% chance of being, 33 and a third percent chance of being any of the three polarizations it could have had. That's the one that actually turns out to be produced in the experiments. That's the statistical combination of spin one states that is actually produced when you produce these Zs through a collision, like an E plus E minus collision, which is the way they're actually produced typically. So let me keep this and write this. I'm going to do this because it's going to make the calculation simpler. And that's going to include the, if I want the total lifetime. So what we're going to do is we're going to sum final over final spins. Sigma and sigma bar equals plus or minus a half. And this corresponds to not measuring them. So that's asking the question not what's the probability of producing or the rate for producing these specific final states, but the conditional probability for finding these two momenta for any possible spins that are not being sampled. And the second thing is, I'm not going to sum over the initial spin of the Z, I'm going to average over it, because I'm going to imagine that I had equal probabilities that they could have been anything. So I'm going to average that could have been plus or minus 1 or 0. And this corresponds to assuming an initial collection of of z's with equal probability of all three. Finding that hair, say having all three. So I'm going to, this means I'm going to sum over the three spins, but I'm going to divide by a third when I do that. That's the only difference. So with that, it's still a differential rate because we haven't followed the momenta. But let's call it a spin averaged rate. So I'll put a bar over it for that. Or maybe spin averaged in the bottom here. I won't write the arguments anymore because it's getting old. So we have 1 over 8 times 3 is 24. Because I have to, this is average means 1/3 sum over C equals plus or minus 1 and 0. So that 1/3 has now made this 8 into 24. That's 2 pi squared. Right. And so we have to evaluate this. But we have to do the sum. I haven't written the sum here yet. So there's a sum over sigma bar and C. And that all these things are appearing in M. That's the point of the exercise, is that if I'm calculating this, C is appearing in here, sigma bar is appearing here, and sigma is appearing here. So you see that in the sum, if I do the sum now, sum there, and the sum over sigma bar. What happens when I change sigma from plus a half to minus a half? All that happens is that S changes sign, right? Because it was defined to be the direction along which the spin is pointing. So I was wrong to tell you that the a better way to say this would be, this is sine of sigma times the thing, because the thing is, S carries the information of the direction of the spin. E is pointing in the direction of the spin, but S points in the direction, if sigma is negative, S points in the opposite direction to the direction along which it would have been if it was pointing, if the sigma had been positive. Right? Because the sign here is telling you which direction S is pointing. And so, I could multiply by 2 sigma, too. The same thing, yeah. But the main thing over here is that means that in this frame, S changes sign when sigma goes to minus sigma. And that means that in all frames, it has to change sign, because that's a statement about four vectors, right? If S mu of minus sigma, S mu of minus sigma is minus S mu of sigma, if that's true in this frame, it has to be true in all frames, because it's a four vector equation. Right? That's why four vectors are good things. So this whole thing is linear in S. So if I sum over sigma, it just means I have to cross off S, because it's the two terms with S are canceling. And the same thing's true here. If I sum over sigma bar, this whole thing is linear in sigma bar, in S bar, so it's going to cancel. So the upshot of the sum over sigma is easy. I just ignore these terms, and that's kind of why I'm doing this. That makes life easy for myself. So I've got E squared over 4 sine squared theta cos squared theta. Sum over C of epsilon mu star, times the trace, m mu n left, m plus I p slash bar, m nu n left, m minus I p slash bar, p slash. Now the sum here is also easy to do, because you remember that these polarization vectors all have the property for spin one particle. When we talked about free spin one massive fields, this thing satisfied, these were three linearly independent vectors which were perpendicular to the four momentum of the Z boson. So they satisfied this same condition, if I use the momentum of the Z boson, these things were all defined to be perpendicular to it.
What about it?
Oh, no, you're right. I'm sorry. Yeah, what you're saying is that these guys cancel, but these guys add. So there's a factor of 2 here, and there's a factor of 2 here, which I should have multiplied, and that cancels the factor of 4. Thank you. Yeah. Damn. Everybody follow that 4? That's important 4. Good catch. So now what about this sum here? Let me do it here. So the sum over C of epsilon mu epsilon star nu, this has to be some matrix which is perpendicular to K, basically, K being the form of momentum of the you know, what can it depend on? This thing depends on K and sigma, K and C, K and C. Once I sum over C, there's no more any dependence on C because I've summed over them all. So this thing has to depend on K. So it's also a tensor. It's something which is transforming under Lorentz transformations as a 4-vector. And so that thing is going to be a tensor which is built out of K and out of the metric. And the only thing it can possibly be is A plus B, A to mu nu plus B, K mu, K nu. It has to be something for some choice of A and B. But it has the property that since epsilon has the property that K mu, epsilon mu is 0, we know that if I take K mu on this whole thing or K nu on this whole thing, I'm going to get 0. And that says that that means that A K mu plus B K squared K mu has to be 0. So that means that A has to be minus B K squared. So we know that this is B minus K squared A to mu nu plus K mu K nu. And you remember, k squared, that's minus k0 squared plus 3k squared. And for the momentum of a z particle, that's just minus the mass squared. So another way I could write this is that this, let me call this whole thing p mu nu. P mu nu is going to be some number times mz squared A to mu nu plus K mu K nu. Now the way to find that number is just to choose a particular simple choice. If I chose these guys, they're three linearly independent vectors depending on how I polarize the Z. I might as well choose, the simplest choice would be to choose one of them in the Z direction, one of them in the X direction, one of them in the Y direction. So that would mean that these are in the rest frame for the K. So here's a choice. Let me write it over here somewhere. So in the frame where K mu is mz 0, 0, 0, a simple choice would be epsilon mu, say, 1 to be 0, 1, 0, 0, epsilon mu 2 could have been 0, 0, 1, 0. Epsilon mu 3 could have been 0, 0, 0, 1. In which case, if I summed up lambda equals 1, 2, and 3 of epsilon mu star for this particular choice of polarizations, I would have got the matrix, you know, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1. That's just saying that I've got an orthonormal basis in the spatial directions. And that was the condition that these epsilons had to satisfy. They were unit vectors which were pointing in the directions of the spins, basically. If you have linearly polarized Zs, these things would be pointing in these three orthogonal directions, much like this is the
much like you could have done for the spin half guy. For circularly polarized things, you know, you can have linear combinations of these things like 1, 0, I, or over root 2, or things like that, but the sum will always be the same. If you're summing three linearly independent orthonormal vectors, you're always going to sum them, they'll always sum to 1 in the spatial directions in the rest frame of the K. So I have to ask, what would B have to be to agree with that in the rest frame of K? And you can kind of see that B has to be 1 over mz squared. Because then, in the rest frame, this is all purely time. It only has the non-zero components in the mu equals nu equals zero directions. And that's going to have to cancel the contribution from this, which it does. That's why we have, this is mz squared, and this is minus mz squared in the time-time directions. But in the space-space directions, it's all coming from this matrix here, which is the unit matrix itself. And so it has the wrong normalization unless B is 1 over m squared. So it says that P mu nu has to be eta mu nu plus K mu nu, K nu over mz squared. So that's simple. That makes this factor quite easy to write. I can just replace it by. So now it's just, we're going to go to town with Dirac matrices. What we need to know is how to take traces of Dirac matrices, and that's actually also something which is not such a big deal. And again, it pays you to take advantage of the symmetries. Now, these gamma matrices have been chosen to transform nicely under Lorentz transformations. So what we need to know is how to do traces involving a whole bunch of gamma matrices here. So trace Dirac traces. So we know that the trace of 1 is 4. It's a 4x4 matrix. The trace of gamma 5 is 0. The trace of gamma mu was 0. And the trace of gamma mu, gamma 5 was 0. By explicitly taking the trace using a basis where we know what these matrices are. That's because these gamma matrices, gamma 5 was diagonal, but it was 1s minus 1s. These gamma matrices, the gamma mu's were all off diagonal. It was 0 something, polymatrix 0, so the trace was 0. And then, so if you multiply them, it's still true. But what about trace of 2 gamma matrices, like gamma mu, gamma nu? What's that equal to? But the gamma matrices were defined. So the claim is this has to be something times the metric for some A. And that's because the gamma matrices were defined to have the property that if I do a Lorentz transformation, there was a specific 4x4 matrix describing Lorentz transformations on spins. And if I did that Lorentz transformation as a similarity transformation on gamma, I got lambda mu nu gamma nu. That was kind of why we defined the gamma matrices the way they were. And that allowed us to say that fermion bar gamma mu fermion was going to behave like a vector, say a 4 vector. So if I use this property here, if I take d inverse, that says that this thing is equal to itself once I contract it with lambda mu nu twice. That says it's an invariant tensor under Lorentz transformations. It's not a covariant tensor, it's an invariant tensor. And there's only one of those, which had two indices. The only invariant tensors for the Lorentz group are eta mu nu and epsilon mu nu lambda rho. And this is a pseudotensor. It changes sign if the determinant of the transformation is negative. So the only thing I can make which is symmetric, has two indices, has got to be proportional to A to mu nu if it's invariant. So we're only arguing about what A is. So then the simplest thing to do is to choose the simplest, some simple case. Let's choose mu equals nu equals 0. In that case, the left-hand side is the trace of gamma 0 squared. We know that gamma 0 squared is minus 1, because there's several ways to think of that. You know, gamma 0 was plus or minus I times beta is one way to think about it. So gamma 0 squared was going to be minus beta squared, and beta squared is to 1, so it was minus 1. Another way to think about it was that the gamma matrices are defined to satisfy this algebra, twice eta mu nu. So if I take the same one, this becomes
If I take mu equals nu equals zero, this is twice gamma zero squared. And the right-hand side is twice a to zero, which is minus two. So that says that gamma zero squared is minus one. All roads lead to Rome. This trace is equal to minus four, because it's a 4x4 matrix. But if I took mu equals nu equals zero on the right-hand side, a to zero is minus one, so that's minus a. So that has to be that a is four. So we know that that has to be true. We want three gamma matrices. The answer has to be some invariant tensor with three indices built into these two. So what's the most general one we can write down? It's zero. There's no way you can get something with three indices with these guys, because to reduce the number of, start with this one, there's not enough. Take two of them, you've got four indices. To remove indices, you'll contract two of them with a metric, but that'll leave you with an even number of indices. You can never get an odd number of indices by contracting these guys in a Lorentz covariant way. So that has to be zero on the grounds of Lorentz. There's nothing else, there's nothing that's Lorentz invariant. And the same argument would work if we had any number of odd ones. So if we have trace of gamma mu 1 to gamma mu 2n plus 1, that has to also be zero because there's no invariant tensor it could be equal to. So the next one would be if we had four, I guess it's the first mu, gamma nu, gamma lambda, gamma rho. If you ask what that has to be, it has to be something involving either two metrics or an epsilon. It actually can't be an epsilon because that's an invariant tensor. It does not change sign when you do. It doesn't depend on the determinant of lambda. There's no determinant of lambda in this transformation. So that thing will be a tensor and not a pseudo-tensor, so it can't actually depend on epsilon. It has to involve only eta. So it could be eta mu nu, eta lambda rho, plus b, eta mu lambda, eta nu rho, plus c, eta mu rho, eta lambda nu, I guess. So then we choose a, b, and c by choosing simple combinations of mu, nu, lambda, and rho. And the answer turns out to be, it's just four, eta mu lambda, eta mu nu, eta lambda rho, minus eta mu lambda, eta nu rho, plus eta mu rho, eta nu lambda. So it's four when you pair the indices that way, and then you change sign whenever you pair the indices by moving this over one more. So you pair them this way and you get a minus sign, pair them that way, you get a plus sign again. As you can easily check by sticking in the appropriate values for mu, nu, and lambda rho. The other one that's easy to write down and is very useful is if you have gamma 5, trace of gamma 5 times an odd number of things. That has to be 0, too, because gamma 5, you remember, was product of gamma 0 times gamma 1 times gamma 2 times gamma 3. So this is a special case of this. It's an odd number of gamma matrices. But the trace of gamma 5 times gamma mu, gamma nu, gamma lambda, gamma rho, this is, again, an invariant tensor. But gamma 5, you remember, satisfied the property that d gamma mu, or sorry, gamma 5, d inverse was the determinant of lambda times gamma 5. So it changes sign under, you know, parity or time reversal, it changes for which the determinant of lambda is negative. So this is not a tensor, this is a pseudo-tensor. So it has the right properties to be proportional to epsilon, and pretty much this is the only thing it could be proportional to, so it's got to be some constant times epsilon mu nu lambda rho. And again, if you choose mu equals 0, nu equals 1, lambda equals 2, and rho equals 3, and just do the trace, this then becomes proportional to gamma 5 again. Gamma 5 squared is 1, and there's a factor of I in that definition. So this becomes 4i times that. So you can eyeball these things. The more indices you have, the more combinatoric pairs you have of indices, and so the more longer it takes to get this to get these coefficients. But this is much simpler than There's a routine that you're told in textbooks as how to calculate these things, and that is you can take any one of these things. If you have an arbitrary even number of these things, you can always anti-commute. You can use this property that I've erased here, that gamma mu, gamma nu is twice eta mu nu. to take gamma mu, gamma nu, and write it as being minus gamma nu, gamma mu, plus this. So this has got fewer gamma matrices in it, so you can kind of recursively get things involving fewer gamma matrices. And the one where you change the order of them, you can repeatedly change the order until you get gamma mu on the other side, and then the cyclic property of the trace allows you to write it as being this thing again. And so you can use this property to iteratively reduce something with more gamma matrices into things involving fewer gamma matrices. And so there's an algorithm you can use to calculate these traces systematically if you want to. But these are the ones we need. So now the next thing we've got to use is that, let's go back in with the lefts and the rights again here. A lot of these things we don't have to keep, you see, because if when we expand these things out, we've got products here, you're going to worry about, if I keep the m times the p slash here, I'm going to get something which is zero, because I've got one gamma matrix, I've got an even number of gamma matrices in n, and then I've got one gamma matrix here. So I've got an even number until I count these two guys. I have to keep an even number of gamma matrices in these two factors to keep get a non-zero trace. So I have to take the m with the m, or the p slash with the p slash bar. Otherwise, it's zero. Right? So most of the trick in doing these traces is just keeping track of those rules. And also the rule that gamma left squared is equal to gamma right squared is equal to 1, and gamma left gamma right is equal to 0. And if you can remember that, then you remember everything. So that trace is going to be trace of all that stuff. It has to be the same thing as gamma mu n left. This is the m squared term, which is going to be times the trace of gamma mu n left gamma nu n left. Right, so here I've taken the m times m. And the other one will be, if I take the p slash times the p slash, there's a minus and there's a plus, so I have minus I times plus I is 1. So then we'll have plus the trace of gamma mu n left p slash bar. And you can see that this is coming down to I don't know if I erased it, but remember n left is T3 gamma left minus Q sine squared theta. So it's convenient. Why don't we write this as being G left gamma left plus G right gamma right. For some choices of, so the way to do that would be to think of this as being T3 minus Q sine squared theta. Just write 1 as being gamma left plus gamma right. Gamma left minus Q sine squared theta gamma right. So this is G left, and this is G right, including the minus sign. That's useful because when I expand these ends out, I can always throw away whenever a gamma left hits a gamma right because of the identity that left with right can be zero. So that makes this easy to do. So we have, when I take a left past the gamma matrix, the gamma 5 changes sign because it anti-commutes. So this n left becomes an n right when I put it next to the past the gamma matrix. So n left with times n right, what's going to survive is if the gamma 5 changes sign, let me write that out. So gamma mu n left gamma nu n left is gamma mu G left, gamma left, plus G right, gamma nu, gamma right. And so if I put this, change the order of the gamma matrices here, I've got G left, gamma right, plus G right, gamma left, because the gamma 5's change sign when I go past the gamma matrix. And if I multiply these guys out, G right squared is G right. Oh, I wrote that wrong over here. Gamma left squared is gamma left. Gamma right squared is gamma right, right? Because of the projection matrices. So gamma mu, gamma nu. So this hits this one. I get G left, right, gamma right, g left, g right, gamma left. So that's 2 g left, g right, gamma mu, gamma nu. So the trace of that is easy. It's just going to be 4 times this. So we've got 8 g left, g right, a to b nu. Same thing for this combination. We've got to put this thing past 2 gamma matrices, so it basically n left will go to n left. And so we're going to have n left squared here. So that'll make, give us g left squared plus g right squared, but no cross terms because the gamma left times the gamma right kills each other. So again, that's going to be the trace of slash is going to be g left squared plus g right squared, gamma left plus gamma right is 1 times the trace of gamma mu p slash bar gamma nu p slash. That's 4 gamma matrices. We know what it is. It's 4 times g left squared plus g right squared times p bar mu p nu, I can track it that way, minus a to mu nu p dot p bar, and I have plus p bar nu p nu. Right, so now let's just go to town. We add that plus m squared times that, contract it with, oh, I erased it. Contract it with, that's too bad, I erased it. We have to contract it with, we had the sum over epsilon mu epsilon nu star, which was a to mu nu plus k mu k nu over m squared. Contract all the indices and you get something, right? So let me just write down what the answer is and then we can cut to the chase. So let me start here, I guess. So I'll just do one step here. So we got 1 over 8 of 2 pi squared, just so you can see where it's all coming from. 1 over D3P over P naught, D3 P bar, over P bar naught, and then 1 over K naught times the matrix element. And the matrix element was, and we had E squared over sine squared cos squared. And we had this A to mu nu plus K mu, K nu over M squared. And we had these traces, which were, so this is all times m squared times that, so 8 m squared. This is the fermion mass that's appearing here, right? This is this g left, g right, a to b nu. And we had 4 g left squared plus g right squared, p mu p bar nu plus p nu p bar mu minus p dot p bar a to mu. And this is just numbers. So if you could track these things, you know, this is always, we're taking dot products of k with p, we're taking trace contractions of p with p dot p bar. And in the rest frame of the z, those are I want to say those are numbers. Now why? I mean, one thing you know about this thing is it has no preferred direction, right? We're going to be interested in doing integrals over these momenta. One of these integrals gets done by the delta function here, the spatial delta function. So the d3p bar, let's say we could do with the three spatial components of the delta function. The length of p, we could do that integral using the remaining energy conservation delta function. And the only integrals that will be left over will be the integral over the direction of the fermion, let's say. That just says something which you knew anyway. If you're in the rest frame of the Z, momentum conservation forces them to come out back to back because momentum has to add up and they have to be equal and opposite. Then energy, if you know the momentum, you know the energy because the energy is just the square root of p squared plus m squared. So that means that if you know the momenta, you know the energy. If the momenta are equal and opposite, their energies have to be equal. And so but the sum of the energies has to add up to the energy that was available to decay. So in the rest frame, if k0 is m, that has to be the sum of the energy of the fermion plus the energy of the fermion bar. But they're equal in the rest frame because their momenta are equal. So that's just twice the energy of the fermion, let's say. So that means that the energy of the fermion is equal to the energy of the antifermion, and that's equal to mz over 2 in rest frame of the decaying particle. That's a general feature of two-body decays. If you have something decaying into two things, energy and momentum conservation can tell you not only what the momenta are, but it tells you what the energy has to be. So that if you wanted a graph of the number of particles, the number of fermions as a function of their energy, in a two-body decay, if these things are all decaying at rest, you would predict a line. They all come out at a very specific energy. If they're not all at rest, then you'll get a distribution depending on what the energies were of the Zs when they were decaying. This is one of the things that, this is how the people discovered neutrinos, right? When the people, nuclei beta decay all the time, that you have a neutron decays to a proton and an electron. And if there had been no neutrino, we know that it decays into an antineutrino as well, but if there had been no neutrino, then in a beta decay like this, you would know that in the rest frame of the neutron, the electron would always have exactly the same energy. So around the turn of the century, it was a big deal to measure the number of electrons coming out in beta decays of nuclei to see, do you always get the same energy, or is there a distribution? And what they found was there was a distribution. And there's a distribution because there's something else carrying off part of the energy. And so if in a three-body decay, you don't have enough information purely in energy and momentum conservation to tell you what the energy has to be in the rest frame of the decaying thing. So the kinematics of a two-body decay is very simple. Everything comes out at a specific energy. If the particles have the same mass, they come out exactly at half the mass of the thing that's decaying. And there's no preferred direction in this problem. So when we evaluate these things, this contraction, we know that it's not going to depend on these angles. The last two angles are going to get integrated over here. We're going to get something which is completely isotropic because there's no direction that's preferred. If we've averaged over the original spin of the Z, that means that all possible directions are equally good because the initial state didn't have a particular spin. There's no direction that was preferred in the problem. That would have been different if we'd kept the polarization of the Z, but we didn't. And so what we know is that this answer, whatever it is, if you directly evaluate it, it doesn't depend on any of the variables you're going to integrate in the end of the day if you use energy momentum conservation. And so that means that you have an isotropic distribution. It doesn't depend on energy because they all have a specific energy. So the answer is just going to be a function of masses. It's not going to be a function of energies or anything. So we're talking about a number here. And so I can write down what that number is. And it is... So gamma, the gamma, so now if I write down what these angles are here, so sine theta, d phi. So these are the angles, these are the directions of the final fermion, say. Theta and phi. If you spherical polar coordinates, the fermion comes out that way, then, you know, we'll measure the projection down to that plane will be here. So this would be theta and this would be phi. That's 1 over, it's E squared over sine squared W, cos squared W, 1 over 48 pi squared times this big square bracket, which I don't know if I want to write. I guess I should write it once. MZ times oh, God, I've written this in a weird way. So I think this is modulo factors of 2, which I can explain. This is G left squared plus G right squared plus 2 G left G right. Actually, that would be 4 times square root of 1 minus 2m fermion squared over mz squared. So this 2 here, I might be lying to you about. As advertised, so the statement is you plug these things in, and you get a constant. And you're getting a constant for a good reason. You're getting a constant because energy momentum conservation dictates the energy of everything. There's nothing it can be a function of except for the masses in the problem and the coupling constants. It turns out to be a good approximation. The mass, you know, with the lightest fermion, the top quark is heavier than the Z particle, so it can't appear in this. So this factor is showing you that if you made the mass of the fermion as big as half the Z mass, this factor goes to zero. And that tells you that shows you why the decay rate goes to zero if the thing you're decaying into becomes as half the mass of the fermion. Energy conservation starts to forbid it. And for everything heavier than that, it's zero. So the top quark won't contribute here, but all the other ones will. The next heaviest compared to the top quark is the bottom quark, for which the mass is 1 GeV or so. It's more like 5 GeV or so. Whereas the Z mass is like 90 GeV. So this is risk ratio here is like 5 90th squared. So it's a very, very good approximation to drop this. It's also a good approximation because of that to make this 1. So most of the story is really here. And so you've got factors which correspond to the coupling constants you had in your Lagrangian. That's a big, so the amplitude was linear in these couplings, the rate is the square of them, so that's why you have that factor. If we integrate it over all the directions, so if we do the integral over 4 pi phase space, then this becomes 1 over 12 pi. The scale of the energy that was available for the decay was mz. On dimensional grounds, you now have the whole answer you needed. G left squared plus G right squared is there because you have an amplitude. The basic interaction had the form z mu, f bar, gamma mu, a matrix, f. And so this thing, because there's one gamma matrix in between these two things, it's always creating a left-handed particle and a left-handed antiparticle, or is creating a right-handed particle and a right-handed antiparticle. And so if the mass had been zero, so we could drop this term, then the handedness of the particle is something you could have measured. So that the rate has to be the incoherent sum of the rate for producing a left-handed particle plus for a right-handed particle. That's why we, in the limit the mass goes to zero, we get something which is the sum of squares of the left and the right-handed couplings here. So all these factors, you can, if you count the 2 pi's that have to be here, the fact that it's a 1 over 2 pi is not a surprise. There's a 2 pi for the 2 pi to the fourth for the momentum conservation delta function. There's a 2 pi cubed for every integral you do. When you do an integral over a direction, you get a 4 pi for the overall solid angle that you could have gone into. So you can count the 2 pi's systematically, and you could defect. The only thing you can't get on dimensional grounds here is the factor of 6. So that's the difference between 12 pi and 2 pi here. So there's no real surprises there. Now, I told you, and I've got to stop here now, that this is a good description of what you see, and that's because people actually measure this. If you ask for, say, the branching ratio for Z goes to BB bar, let's say, or Z goes to E plus E minus, or Z goes to neutrino bar, the branching ratio is just defined to be the rate for Z goes to whatever we're talking about divided by the rate for Z to go to anything. And this is the same thing would be true here. all the constants that you don't know here, you know, the two pi's and things, these are the same for all of them. So that cancels in these ratios. These ratios only depend on these couplings, g left and g right. So the branching ratio for, you know, z goes to fermion, fermion bar is going to be just given by g left for that fermion squared plus g right squared for that fermion divided by the sum over all fermions of the same thing. Where I'm neglecting the fermion masses, which is a good approximation. And so you can measure all these things. You can measure the rate for z to go to electron pairs, to muon pairs, to tau pairs. You would expect that this ratio should be the same for muon, tau, and electrons because they were all just different generations of the same quantum numbers, so they all have the same coupling constants. And that's what you see that the accuracy you should see. There are small differences because their masses are different, and so if you keep these kind of terms, then you see that they're a little bit different, but what you see is exactly what you should be seeing. If you look for things that have B particles in them, you get what you expect to get. This kind of thing shows up as Z goes to nothing because you don't see the neutrinos. In a detector, what happens is that the mass of the Z is something like 90 GeV, and the rule of thumb is that 100 MeV inverse corresponds to 10 to the it's to 1 Fermi in distance, and that corresponds to 10 to the minus 23 seconds in time. So something, if you ask how long does this something take to decay, it's going to take most of the, you know, there's a numerical factor here, which is this is something like 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus, another 10 to the minus 1 here, so this is 10 to the minus 5 or something like that. So you're getting something which is 10 to the 5 times bigger than this. But it's going to travel, if it's traveling at the speed of light, it's going 10 to the minus 15 centimeters. It's not going at all anywhere in your detector that you can see, so it's pretty decaying immediately. You don't see where it's going. You only see its decay products. And so that's not true for other things. The muon, for instance, decays with a lifetime of something like 10 to the minus 6 seconds. And so you can actually see muons leave your detector, and electrons you can see leave your detector. Tau particles, you can see them, they go like a few microns and then they decay, but they go far enough that you can actually measure that where they've gone. And so you can distinguish taus from muons from electrons because they just behave differently in the detector. You can hadrons, these quarks actually, what you really see is that the Z goes into a bunch of particles involving hadrons, protons and pions and things. So you can, the sum of the rate into all strongly interacting particles corresponds to summing over all possible quarks, and you get that right. The rate for Z to go to nothing is hard to measure because you don't see nothing very well, but what you can do is you can measure the total. If you look at the energy, these Zs are produced in E plus E minus goes to Z, goes to stuff, and as you'll see next term, if you measure the cross-section of this as a function of energy, there's a big resonance that happens where at the Z mass. If this is the energy of the electron, let's say. And the width of this resonance is the total decay weight of the Z particles, what you'll see next term. And so that's the thing which you're getting here. That's this thing, gamma, when you summed everything. And so by measuring the rate to go into quarks and into B quarks and into charged leptons and comparing it to the total rate, which you can measure this way, you can figure out what the rate is to go to nothing. And then you can check that by looking for the process where you go to nothing plus a photon, where you see the photon. So this is where the electron comes. The electron, say, radiates a photon before it goes to the Z, which goes to nothing. And they all give you the same answer. And so these things are measured to a precision of better than a percent. So that these couplings are very well measured because of reactions like this, largely through their contribution to the decay rate that you can see here. So if you sit down with a particle data book and compare these formulas, you'll see that they work very well. So that's probably a good place to stop. So thanks for hanging in there. The assignment, it's due 2 weeks from now, right? And that's driven by that's what I'll do is I'll come in that day, or I'll get Leanne to courier it to me that day. So it has to get here that day. Because, so what I was saying is that the deadline 2 weeks from now is a hard deadline. That if you miss it, it won't get to me in time for me to mark it before January when the marks need to be submitted. On that day, I'm not completely sure yet. If I'm not here, I'll have it arranged that people, it'll be couriered to me the following morning, so or that night. So I'm normally here on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. But if so, Wednesdays are reliable because of the colloquia. Although on that day, there's no colloquium that day, the 20th. I'll email you about that question. Well, don't get hung up. Don't kind of stop doing things and you know, don't get paralyzed by that question. You know, no, press on with. Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. Okay. Well, you know, if you haven't heard from me, that I think I can do actually quite quickly, but if you haven't heard from me when you hand it in, then don't worry about that particular question. But, you know, you should not panic about the marking of this thing. It's the so let me take the mic.